The wider setting is that we're still talking about America, that is a prolongation of the celebration of the national anniversary. There's also a considerable parallel conversation going on in Mel Peel's series on religion and politics. So I doubt that anything will surface now that isn't already somehow in the process of conversation elsewhere, but that's good reason to pursue it further. In what sense does Martin Luther King throw light on America? I propose to introduce this with just a couple glancing approaches to the total phenomenon represented by King, thinking that some of them may then spark your further response and we can follow things further. There is now the definitive collection of his writings called A Testament of Hope, the Essential Writings. It includes sermons and occasional speeches, magazine articles, and major extracts from the major books, all in one collection, adding up to 670-some pages, edited by James M. Washington. And this is the library copy here, so it's available for anybody that would want to pursue it further. He wrote in all about 6 books, but quite a number of occasional things that otherwise would not have been accessible. In 20 years since the assassination of King, we have named him the honoree of a national holiday, first time that's happened for a long time. And then there are debates about whether that applies in Arizona and what it means. But it isn't easy to have a precise view of just what did happen, what it was that he did. And I think with time, there is probably a mistakenly affirmative understanding of how much was done by King, especially since he is a type or a prototype of numerous questions that people continue to think about. He could be listed as one of the mentor figures behind the Holden vision. So I'll point especially to a few questions in the interpretation of what he did. First, a question that was discussed before he came along in the mainstream Protestant university and divinity school world in which he got his own higher education. That is, after going to one of the elite black colleges in the South, he went to Crozer, which was a relatively liberal Baptist seminary, for a regular seminary degree near Philadelphia, and then to Boston University School of Theology, one of the two most liberal Methodist graduate schools, for his doctorate, in which he did a dissertation on 2 white Protestant philosophical theologians' views of God. So something very philosophical and ambitious, very intellectual, having very little to do with what was going to come next. But that means that he was at home in the world of mainstream Protestant moral thinking. And the biggest name, clearly in that period, and a person from whom he also says he learned much, was Reinhold Niebuhr, who had taken a very strong and pointed position on the question of violence and nonviolence, which is therefore pertinent, because in some ways King agreed with him and in other ways not. Niebuhr said there is a radical difference between rejecting violence because of the gospel, because you read the teachings or the work of Jesus or the testimony of the early Christians as calling for the renunciation of all violence, And then you do have to renounce all violence and all selfishness and all pressure and be willing to suffer. There's a profound difference between that and nonviolent action, which was perfectly conceivable in the 30s because Gandhi was doing it on the other side of the globe. And Niebuhr says those are two completely different kinds of activity. Nonviolent action, nonviolent pressure, nonviolent resistance is a form of coercion. You may say that it's for good in the long run, but it is not a loving response to the person that you take India. If you take India away from the British Empire, it's not a loving response to the British. So non-resistance would be consistent. It goes back to Jesus and Tolstoy and is well represented by the Amish, conservative Mennonites who stay out of society. That's a position that is consistent. By being pure in the renunciation of all power, coercion, and involvement, you signal to everybody else that they are impure, that they are compromising, that they ought to be aware of their imperfections, and that signal of purity is always a good thing to have around. But of course, you shouldn't think that by that purity you're doing the world any good. The people who do the world any good are the ones who make compromises and get their hands dirty, doing the best they can. And in that setting, nonviolent action may sometimes be the most efficient way of getting your hands dirty and being unloving and putting pressure on people in your own righteous interests. In fact, Niebuhr predicted more than 20 years before King that American blacks will probably only be able to get their rights through nonviolent action of a Gandhian style. But it's not the same as the way of Jesus. It's coercion. It's twisting people's arms. It's making people do things they don't want to do. Well, one of the questions to take into the ongoing conversation is that polarity. Is it the case that purity, non-resistance, at the price of having nothing concrete to do with the society, and effectiveness, which may minimize violence but is not really non-violent because it is coercive and it's not the way of Jesus because you would prefer not to be crucified, are two basically different ways of dealing with human conflict, so that you have to choose between the two. The fact that both of them say violence is bad is confusing because they say it for different reasons. The people of the Gandhian style say that violence is bad because the renunciation of violence is more effective. You don't trigger backlash and you don't give the cops or the British Empire the opportunity to hit you back with impunity. So that's a first question that's lying there in wait before King comes along, and which still makes people differ as to what King was doing when he used the language of the gospel to advocate his position. Was he confusing the categories, or was he really doing something that did follow from the gospel? And Niebuhr's analysis was not the only way to analyze. A second question became, the next two questions I like to look at are those that became especially urgent in the last 5 years of his activity. Roughly after Birmingham, which was the main relatively visible success in the South, the time of which he wrote his most widely circulated book, Why We Can't Wait, which is his own telling of the story up through Birmingham. Then various things happened. They moved north. They started talking about other topics. And he began being disavowed by people who had supported him before. And this happened especially in two directions. The one direction started using the slogan Black Power. Now, he was not absolutely closed to using those words, but he sensed that it was politically very dangerous to make much of them, and that the people who used them the most freely were actually going to set the movement back because their readiness to use violence if necessary, or at least to talk about using violence if necessary, was going to provoke more resistance, more defensiveness on the part of the entrenched white establishment, And obviously, blacks were still, in most places, a minority, and they just can't afford to make violence the level on which things get decided. And interestingly, his argument against Stokely Carmichael and the other people who were talking about black power was largely at that point on the level of practicality. Obviously, telling Stokely Carmichael that Jesus wouldn't be violent wouldn't help much. But saying it'll set the movement back was the kind of discussion that he could carry on, and he did try to carry on as kind of the younger elder statesman of the black liberation movement, that it's understandable psychologically why impatient younger leaders would want to push harder and use the language of fighting back, but it'll set the movement back. So that's one debate that was never finished as long as he lived, and it was getting worse rather than better as things escalated on to his assassination. The other debate was whether it is appropriate for this human rights or civil rights movement of American blacks, who could very clearly, when that was what they were asking for, appeal to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and to the central institutions, that is the Supreme Court was usually on their side when they would take a particular issue up through the courts. The Kennedy family was usually on their side, and then Lyndon Johnson, when a particular issue was so hot that it would benefit by actual intervention from the executive branch. As long as the basic moral case for the right to vote, the right of access to public facilities was at stake, it was a winning cause, even though it didn't win very fast, because with the separation of state jurisdictions and all the rest, it was very hard to follow through on successes. But then, actually apparently beginning quietly in 1965, already writing little newspaper articles in 66, but becoming very public in April of 67, came out against the Vietnam War, which completely blasted the bridges between him and Lyndon Johnson. From then on, there was no coalition anymore, as there had kind of been between him and Johnson, in that the Democratic administration saw it as good politics to keep at least a little pressure behind movement in the direction of greater rights for blacks. From that time on, Lyndon Johnson didn't return his calls, and didn't have any interest in helping the movement any further. Should he or should he not have got his ministry mixed up? Most of the other civil rights agencies, Urban League, with its base in local social service centers, and the NAACP, with its major concentration on taking cases to court, both of them said, not that the Vietnam issue isn't an issue, not that the Vietnam War is a good thing, but that we are a one-cause agency, and we shouldn't take on those other causes. King said he has to take on that other cause. And he pushed his own organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Council, against considerable reticence among his lieutenants to support it. And one of the questions is, should a leader push that hard when his lieutenants aren't with him? But he felt he had to, very publicly, and of course then there was no going back. Why did he have to do it? Well, partly he just made a moral statement, I'm a Christian pastor and war is wrong, which meant that he was getting more and more pacifist on this straight level of the morality of war. But the more credible argument for many people was that the Vietnam War is itself a racist activity. We wouldn't be doing that if there were a split between Northern Holland and Southern Holland, and we were supporting the Northern Dutch. It's only because it's small brown people over there that we are as free as we are to wage the war the way we are, and it's also largely a war that's waged by American blacks, because in the absence of the draft, it's mostly poor young men that get into the army. So there was a disproportionate number of blacks in the army and among the victims. So it is a part of the race issue. And then lastly, it's economically a part of the race issue, because the money that goes into the war can't go into housing and jobs. So he made a strong case for needing to move from civil rights to the Vietnam War, but he lost a large part of his momentum and his popularity. So the Black Power question and the Vietnam question had largely slowed down the momentum of his movement by the time he was assassinated. Whether it would have picked up again, nobody can estimate, of course. There was the plan for the March on Washington that summer, which was carried through after his death with ambivalent results. The Southern Christian Leadership Council still exists, but it's a much more modest agency. It isn't running nationwide campaigns for anything. So the critical readers surprise us with the idea that the King operation did not actually succeed. In most of the campaigns that were undertaken, there were very ambivalent results. Birmingham was one of the stronger ones. But the effort to integrate housing in Chicago got a lot of public attention for a while, and then was finally settled in a so-called summit agreement with Mayor Daley, who made a lot of promises that everybody knew he didn't intend to keep, but King was willing to let it stand with that, as if that were a victory. And numerous times that had been the case, so that there enters into American history the sense that this black liberation cause has been powerfully moved forward, and if enough people think that, it has been. But if you look at the pieces of the program, not many of them got very far. So there's something about the way a figure, partly in connection with being martyred, partly in connection with being enormously important in the media, charismatic in that sense, can take on a larger than life dimension in the ongoing life of the country, where actually he didn't win many of his battles. And that's a different picture of him. I've had it refreshed for me just by rereading some of the sources, even seen it more clearly than before. If a social scientist looks at one campaign at a time, most of them didn't achieve the stated results. King was much more ready than Gandhi would have been, or was in analogous circumstances, to accept as a resolution a formal agreement which later the white establishment wasn't going to keep. Or even sometimes an informal agreement, an oral statement that never even got written down, because it could be announced for the time being to the marchers as having achieved what they came for. So that's one set of questions. I think it's the one that we need to keep alive if we're trying to understand this epoch of American history that ended just 20 years ago, and what kind of a heritage it leaves us, that the heritage is somehow, the whole is bigger than the sum of its parts. The achievement is more affirmative than anything that got done, piece by piece. And maybe that's some kind of common grace operative in the political realm. But sometimes the long range sense of what happened is more positive than what actually happened if you looked at it one tree at a time. Then the one other thing that isn't quite a part of that same package that I thought it would be appropriate that we think about in connection with yesterday is to what extent King's vision is America. As you know, he made much of the founding documents and the national hymnology, From Every Mountainside Let Freedom Ring, which became the high point of his March on Washington speech. It's one of our national hymns. He was a rhetorician, he was a preacher. He didn't at all, wasn't at all embarrassed about repeating himself, using the same sermon in different places, or using the same illustration or the same poem more than once. And all of that was the rhetoric of American liberty. He talked as if he trusted the American ideals, and that it was just the other people's fault for not living up to them. In Why We Can't Wait, in 63, he used the image of an overdraft, that is, America has written a check which it's not willing to cover. It promised us freedom in 1863, and they haven't delivered yet on that promise. So he is actually a very patriotic American. He believes very strongly in the rhetoric of freedom for all, despite the fact that his people don't have that freedom, and when taken on the global economic and social scale, didn't have it much more when he died than when he'd started. Or today. If you ask about the right to vote or the possibility of having a black man in public office in a place where there are enough people to elect him, that has been a deep change, more in the South than in the North. But we also have black mayors in the North, in the center cities. But if you ask about the median income of black families, the distance between blacks and whites is worse than it was 20 years ago. So there has not been a fundamental change in America, if you mean economics, and the wherewithal for bringing up your children. There has been a change on the surface of access to political office and to the vote. Well, so much for an effort just to open up to take the lids off some of the boxes we might want to look into, depending on your own priorities and memories.
It's my understanding that he's credited primarily with advocating a nonviolent approach to difficulties, which if he had not done, might have produced some violence here and there. Is that a fair evaluation?
Well, it's a very appropriate pointer to a still debated question. When he first began, he was not a doctrinaire pacifist. But he was very clear that only nonviolent means would work in this setting. His wife Coretta was actually a committed pacifist from her college days, but she didn't force that on him. But in connection with the bombing of his house, and then in connection with the people who came to assist in getting the movement going in Montgomery, he moved toward a formal commitment to nonviolence as a moral obligation, not only as a tactic, which is where he stayed for the rest of his life. That is so from then on, his commitment against violence was both tactical and principled. Now, did this decrease the violence that might have taken place? The historians that I've been able to read don't really know how much violence would have taken place if he hadn't opened the Pandora's box in the first place. Once you give people a sense of movement, and then they're disappointed, their impatience may be your fault in some sense. That's the puzzle. That is, obviously, he said, if you follow me, you won't use violence. But the people out on his left became more and more numerous, saying, we're not going fast enough this way. And there was actual violence on the fringes of the movements that he led, especially in Memphis just before his assassination. There was one garbage workers march where 6,000 people were perfectly nonviolent, but 30 ruffians made it look like a riot. You can't keep that from happening. I mean, not very easily anyway. I mean, it's very difficult to have the kind of marshalling or the kind of internal structure that can keep that from happening. So a very few people who don't accept criticism can blow the whole thing for the media, and for the nation. And in that sense, there are some of his critics, especially his conservative white critics, who would say that he took the lid off the thing and made things begin to percolate, which therefore created all the violence that did happen. And if he hadn't made trouble in the first place, there wouldn't have been that. So that's the ambivalence behind your question. Certainly his intent was to prevent all violence. Certainly in particular cases where he was able to get in touch with people, even black street gangs, he was able to get them to say that for tactical purposes they wouldn't use violence this time. And he had considerable credibility with those people on the short range. But the calls for violence and the actual readiness to use it were increasing because the white establishment didn't move as fast as he wanted it to. I promised it might.
Trivial question on the Vietnam situation. In the light of the earlier forum discussion tonight, I'm not as aware of some of the journals and articles and all. I remember my first contact with that, was it not with a series of radio broadcasts during Advent and Christmas over the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation? That's where I first read the Vietnam. Now, had he written about it before that, or were those actually the initial? But it was interesting because it was the persons I read were from a pulpit and were broadcast by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, as I recall.
Yeah, it came out, it was printed then posthumously as the Trumpet of Conscience.
That was it. That was a book that was printed, and that was the.
But that was. No, it wasn't posthumous. It was 67.
And again, it came from the pulpit sort of process, not the political. And it came not in this country. Now, did it originally, you know, was that his foundation, or had he written ahead of that?
He had written, especially, he had a column in a black Chicago paper. I don't know if it's a weekly or monthly. The Defender.
The Chicago Defender, daily.
It's a daily. There he had written in early 66. The publication of the Trumpet of Conscience was 67, so it might even be that that was broadcast in Canada that early.
Okay.
The big New York statement in the Riverside Church was April 67. And that completely blew it with Johnson because it was so public.
But again, the relationship to the pulpit, I thought, was interesting, mm-hmm. and the fact that that was not an American pulpit, but it was a Canadian pulpit.
Also, there's an early kind of phase of this. The first time he ever said anything in public about the rest of the world before Vietnam, it was South Africa. And he first mentioned that when he was on the way to Oslo to get the Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. Only then did he start thinking of himself as a world citizen, having some responsibility to speak to other things than his own project.
Would he have emerged more as a world spokesperson rather than simply a national civil rights spokesperson? A combination of the Peace Prize, a combination of his using other pulpits, a combination of his. I realize it's strictly speculation.
Well, there was some readiness to that precisely. 68 was the year that some Democrats said we have to have somebody to run against Johnson, and then Johnson decided not to run. So all of a sudden it was not completely out to be against Vietnam and be a respectable politician. And then Robert Kennedy became critical of the Vietnam thing, although John, his brother, got us into it. So the fact that from 65 to 67, it was not acceptable that he act like a person with a world vision,
okay,
could maybe have come to a turning, mm-hmm, if 68 had gone differently. And there had been a beginning of resonance for the idea that the coinciding of his civil rights debate and his Vietnam judgment were was mutual reinforcing rather than mutually confusing. So that conceivably could have happened. But it was the loss of momentum within the black movement itself that I mentioned before, because of the black power challenge. That would be the real question. If the Memphis Garbage Workers Organization cause had given them a new lease on life, then that might have been a new basis. But Chicago not having worked well really meant that numerous people were writing articles, major magazines had articles saying that he's lost, that he's no longer the leader.
I understand, or I've seen reference to the fact that King's doctoral dissertation was on Martin Luther or some aspect of Luther's work. Do you know anything about that?
No. I don't know what his earlier, whether he had a thesis for the BD, but the PhD itself was purely philosophical. It was the Doctrines of God of Paul Tillich and Henry Nelson Weedman. He had seen those two people argue once and thought it was fun, so he went back to the divinity school and his supervisor said, okay, you can try that for a thesis. Earlier he had apparently, when he was back at Crozier Seminary, he had some first pictures of Gandhi and had done papers related to Gandhi, but the place I suspect he would have come on Luther would have been in Niebuhr. The question of the abiding sinfulness of any human effort and that kind of question. I don't remember reminiscences from his actually referring to anything Luther. He's in the index once. In the letter from the Birmingham jail, here I stand, I can do no other. Civil disobedience.
Would you analyze the events leading up to the declaration of a national day? How come this happened if his influence was relatively small? Or what is that a fair evaluation? I sense that it is from what you're saying.
Well, I haven't gone back to study that story since my rereading of the other material, so I think that'd be something we could do together. And others of you certainly have been watching it and knowing as much about it as I. There is some mystery about martyrdom. That there are certain questions that you don't ask with the same rigor anymore. And I can't quite figure out how to reason to explain that that's good or bad or shouldn't be or should be. But it does give certain images, a certain leverage in a society that a major figure was killed for that. We don't do that with hundreds of little people. We won't have a holy day for the, or maybe Iran will for these 290 people we just killed, but if it's a very prominent personage, then martyrdom itself seems to give leverage that other people use. And obviously he didn't ask for it, it was a certain segment of the political world and the constituency of the politicians who made it appear that a day in honor of King would identify a day in honor of King would redound to the credit of politicians who won votes in the major cities of the country where most voters are black. So that I haven't seen a journalistic description of how it happened, but is it the bad conscience of the country that we aren't dealing with the basic reasons that blacks are getting farther and farther behind as a total population? But at least we'll dramatize some kind of a symbolic mea culpa in recognizing that this person who stands for some proper components of the American vision is something like a founding father of a part of what our society wants to be, even though we aren't.
In your initial comments, you mentioned the mixed bag, some gains and yet some non-gains for black Americans. The gains being in the overt political arena, the lack of real gains in the economic area. And within the black community, there even seems to be disagreement. Some blacks saying, such as Jesse Jackson, that economic violence is being committed. Other blacks saying that the opportunities are there, but there are other factors, such as the breakup of the black family, mm-hmm. which are devastating black culture of Martin Luther King's life. Could you speculate and guess as to where he would stand on that argument today within the black community, whether he'd take one side or the other?
I think in the middle, not, he wouldn't try to be in the middle, but I think he wouldn't be at either extreme. He was authentically the predecessor of Jesse Jackson, who tells people, try harder, push, you can excel. That is a very strong call for personal discipline, getting skills, being able to enter the job market if there is a job available. Soap and sanitation. In that sense, King followed Gandhi, and the call to simple cultural survival values, for which underprivileged people always need to have more help to learn, was always part of his what he was promoting. If you can't get into college, you can at least buy a bar of soap, that kind of language he would use. So there was always some recognition that this promise, that the problem of collapsed family values, or the absence of a work ethic, or the absence of a sense of long-range investment and deferred gratification for valuable cultural goals, are things that haven't been taught to the average black teenager the way they have to the average white teenager. Like, there's always some recognition that there are aspects of our cultural readiness for joining the mainstream that we can work on ourselves, and that we can't ask the whites to give us. And yet I think he would still argue pretty strongly on the other side that it isn't the choice of the unwed mother, once she is where she is, the welfare mother, not to be able to start your children off somewhere else in life. Once you're in those boxes, the only kind of help that will really change would be structural help. And that there may even be things about the welfare system that propagate or that prolong that style rather than helping people to get out of them. I think we see some of that in Jesse Jackson. He says at the same time that we can do more, and we need to heighten our own self-esteem, and I tell you, you are somebody. And yet, when you talk to the wider society, you talk about the points in which the wider society ought to help people get onto an even playing field. You could say more from your Chicago setting, probably, about this kind of thing.
Jesse. A couple of things about Dr. King, just to underline your own I think, your own perspective. I first met him when I was in SNCC in 63, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and my friends were all people who thought that Dr. King was terribly, terribly conservative and terribly compromising and not willing to go fast enough. The argument was not over nonviolence and violence. It was over tactical questions within nonviolence.
Patience.
That's right.
And willingness to settle for half a loaf.
That's right. And where you would spread, what you were willing to take on in the South in particular. So for a long time, the only people in the movement that I knew were people who considered Dr. King already a little bit passé. I then ran into him next when I moved to Chicago, which was about the time when he tried to bring the civil rights movement north. And I think, if anything, you have understated how much of a brick wall he ran into. I think that he came away thinking that he had constructed a set of tactics and a way of being that really needed total overhaul to be effective at all in the North. I really think he felt like he didn't feel like he got a victory from Mayor Daley. He felt like he could sort of get out of town with his head sort of held high, but he knew that nothing had been accomplished. And I remember going on a couple of marches with him into the Southwest Side in Cicero, when, in fact, at his press conferences afterwards, he was almost speechless with horror at what he had seen and at the comparative depth of racism in the North. He began to rethink the South as a sort of scene of civility, right? Compared to the North, was relatively easy pickings. So I don't think he was ready to tackle the sort of institutional and economically sanctioned apartheid that American cities had developed by the time he got there. And just a third suggestion about the martyrdom question. I do think that it's impossible to overstate the amount of latent and often, I think, unstated guilt in the American psyche about race, in the white American psyche about race. It does seem to me as Myrdal told us in the 40s already, the American dilemma, the major Achilles heel of the American experiment. And there's a sense in which the martyrdom of King, it seems to me, is a way for both black and white Americans to symbolically proclaim the possibility of something else. But for whites, it seems to me, probably is still too easy a way out, right? It's a symbol with the possibility of leading us away from the substance once again. King is better than the alternatives. Lots of ways. King is better than Malcolm X. I mean, most people in the black community think about King and Malcolm X as the sort of two ways of viewing their realities. At least people in northern cities do. And most young ones will buy Malcolm X still.
Well, more his language than his program.
Well, that's right. His program, in some way, came to be sort of international in his last year. I think the King Jackson line is really interesting to think about. I can't imagine King having to go back to some of the questions Mel was raising in his session. I can't imagine Dr. King ever being at home running for office any place. I mean, had he lived, can you, Mel? I mean, I can't imagine him having, whatever his role was on the American stage, it didn't have that element as a part of it, it seems to me, ever, right? Certainly his followers did. I mean, Andy Young and lots of others did immediately.
There is a prophetic quality there that's hard to pin down, I think, that puts him in a different category. I was going to observe on the national holiday thing, it seems to me that that, in a way, is still very open for definition. It has been done at the Guild and Martyr level, but there is sort of two versions of the king story that I see being done on the holiday. One is the sort of celebratory, we have a little problem here in our democracy with integration and voting rights. Along came this decent man. Yes, there was some flurry, but the system worked. He succeeded. Everything turned out fine. And unfortunately, he got shot, but we honor his accomplishment.
Because he did achieve political access.
That's right. I mean, he succeeded in what were his primary goals, his life. The other version, though, which I think is the more interesting one, is that his own goals, well, he always had, I think, a larger goal of touching American racism, really. Even from the beginning, he understood that the public access and voting rights was only an aspect of that. But as Jody said, he was a tactical conservative, very much, and a believer, and a committed believer in nonviolence. But I think the last 3 years of his life, it seems like to me that he was digging deeper into the roots of the issue, and the whole question then of economics really altering the forms of the system, but also the psychology of race, really getting after that in a very profound way, so that the holiday can be read two ways, either as a celebratory, look what we did, or even on Dr. King's terms, look how very much more there is to do. And how it will get celebrated is an interesting question.
On our way, we get a column about once a week by Coretta. Do you see that going somewhere, or her going somewhere, in terms of leadership?
I haven't seen it. What does she write about?
Racial issues.
Where do you see it? Where is it?
I think it's either the Oregonian or else our local paper in Vancouver, Washington.
It's in the Oregonian.
It's Oregonian.
I didn't know that the general, the center in Atlanta, there are various research institutes and archives and other ways to cultivate the memory and the momentum. I just didn't know about a syndicated column. There is certainly a growing maturity to caring for that momentum and that heritage, but I doubt that anyone in that circle would think that institution would be a basis for running for office, that Coretta would run for office. Rather, that she would kind of continue to be the keeper of the prophetic flame and let people like Andy Young go into the mainstream of politics and take over the city with, again, a basically this tactical conservatism that he has made Atlanta the economic center of the Southeast, and the more the better. The freeway through Atlanta is now 10 lanes wide and they're making it 12. They have been employing people building freeway for the past 20 years without interruption. It's a major part of the job market. So he has a sense of running the community with its ordinary economic resources, and we may be gaining on the problem. Jesse doesn't think that from Chicago, and he shouldn't think that way in Chicago. But one thing that also would have to do about with the meaning of the 4th of July, or maybe rather the adoption of the Constitution than the Declaration of Independence. Is it really the case that access to the vote and to public office makes much difference King certainly believed that. You can, there would be pietists and other kinds of conservatives who would kept saying, well, you can't enforce morality. And he always said, well, the law can't make somebody love me, but they can keep him from lynching me, and that's better. And that's an adequate answer, but to keep people from lynching you is not yet justice, and it's not yet freedom ringing from every mountainside. So it might be that the modesty of the results of the whole King project should tell us that we have overdone the importance of the electoral process in what it takes to be a healthy society, and that we think too easily that if you can get a law passed or you get a person into an office, that you have solved some basic problem. Maybe that's just generally not true. And maybe Anglo-Saxons have overvalued the importance of the formal management process of the state as over against other levels of reflexes and other ways decisions get made.
Jesse Jackson, I guess.
Well, if we were Jesse, or if we were his advisors, maybe Jody is, how far should we want him to get? That is pushing Dukakis a little to the left, and thereby decreasing his electability, what's that good for? Again, the idea that to run a candidate on some cause is the way to take responsibility for society. In our two-party system, where the guy closest to the middle is most likely to get elected, there are many good causes that can't possibly be electable. I don't think we have adjusted our own political thinking to realism about the fact that if you knew exactly what ought to happen, it could never happen through the system.
You've heard the quip that we can't have a black in as president, because after all, he'd live in the White House.
I think it's clear that Jackson has expanded the discussion in this year, terrifically, and that mainstream Democrats are paying attention to the entire Southern Hemisphere and the entire Third World in ways that they would never do without that. That it's safer to talk about at least putting a cap on military spending than it would be without Jesse saying that he would reduce it. And that he's allowing for some new economic thinking to begin to percolate, at least some possible different relationship between the state and the economic system, you know, plant closing stuff and so on. It does seem to me at this point his major interest is that he expands the discussion in addition to bringing lots and lots of new people onto the public stage, right? Otherwise, would have no reason to be there. Would be hopeless, I think, basically. I was just—I've seen this in Chicago, but I was just in Los Angeles a couple of months ago, where I met with a bunch of black leaders from South Central Los Angeles and got for the first time a sense of what Jackson's campaign has meant for.
For
other places, and they said they had never felt the kind of street level excitement, which has redounded to the benefit not only of the Jackson campaign, but of virtually every community organization, every civic organization, even the more active churches in the black community in Los Angeles. There's a kind of ferment there, which I found really interesting. I hadn't seen that in Chicago because it happened 5 years ago when Washington was elected mayor, and that, so it's already happened in Chicago and didn't get a chance to happen again. But if that, if Jesse's even doing that in cities around the country, it seems to me terrifically important.
But I felt some of that with Geraldine too.
Well, yeah, I'll bet. I'll bet. Yeah.
Los Angeles can be unique too, because number one, Jesse had been there through the high school process for about 3 years, 4 years. And then secondly, Bradley has become a white mayor.
Yes.
I mean,
they always have been.
Yeah, you can't, But you can't, Los Angeles does have some exceptional. And there is a frustration in the black community.
Yes.
It doesn't seem like it's real. It's basically black and white. It's who is going to care enough to change our economic status in this country and lessen the gap between the wealthy and the poor.
You talked about it earlier in the Mel session, I think, talking about the way in which there is in the black church a blending of public life and morality and religion, that does sort of carry that vision in a way that lots of moral and religious people in the white communities just don't have in our background.
Right? It's even to the point of absurdity, because in the recent election in June, Kenny Hahn, who was a supervisor who was a white, for the black supervisorial district was elected, even though the man has been at less than 1/20th of supervisorial meetings, yet the black community completely carried him into office because there was not it's a frustration. I mean, it's just not right. There's something wrong with that, even though it's good, because that's it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And he had a stroke a week later.
But I'm thinking about you, I've read recently about a lot of the black yuppies today.
Puppies.
Like anybody else, you become so enamored with stuff, and when you reach the certain stage of wealth, and so everyone else is forgotten. I mean, it's no different for blacks or whites.
Some analysts of cities say that the major thing that's happened to the black community in the last 20 years, the most significant thing that's happened to the black community, is a class split, right?
Skimming off the upwardly mobile, making it easier for them.
Mm-hmm. Even geographically separating people now from the very poor black neighborhoods. That's part of what you were asking too, about splitting the black community.
So if we became a socialist state, would we? What would happen to racism?
There's another four.
I'm wondering if it would.
Well, there's
Jesse Jackson doesn't have that.
Soviet Union claims to be socialist, and it's not much less racist than we are. Sweden isn't very.
What'd you say
about Sweden? Isn't very racist because they don't have many minorities to be frightened by, so they can tolerate the few minority people they have.
Britain is certainly racist.
Increasingly so, it's getting worse rather than better.
Yeah.
But it's also getting less socialist. I'm puzzling about your pointing that out. It's obviously the case that one could say simply that the economic injustice is less and less correlated with the racial components of injustice, in that a black person can rise politically or professionally. And I think that King and Jackson would say that there's still a tilt to the way in which we keep one set of people in poverty and another set not, that still has a racial component to it.
No.
But it would be harder to argue once both politics and professional advancement in, say, medicine or law or small business are more open to blacks than they used to be. Why it is the blacks that are left behind and not the Vietnamese immigrants or the Koreans. There's something that has a racial quality to it that is still counted against that of those people. Or in Miami, the Cuban immigrants have very rapidly leapfrogged over the blacks into social and economic leadership. So now that black people are bumped out of jobs because they're not bilingual. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like we could still blame all that on family structure when the white family is going down the tubes pretty fast. I don't know. Has been pointed out so much in the past. The family structure of the black has been so.
Or could the blacks be a leading indicator?
Could be a what?
Might they be a leading indicator? Might we begin to see white poverty with the same basic?
Mm-hmm.